If you want to get your favorite technical news, give the Gizmo Gang a call. Gizmo Sapiens.
Hey, and welcome to Gizmo Sapiens Show 182. I'm Chris, and with me today is...
I am Matt.
I think you were with me the last three or four times we've done this.
Perhaps.
You're usually with me, actually.
Known to happen.
So, this is kind of a tech update episode, although there are a few things I'm going to cover that are reminiscent of that we missed in our last show, partly because they came up after we recorded the last show, and in the entertainment field.
Okay.
I'm shooting to actually possibly do at least two more episodes this month. I'd like to get the professor on Microsoft Teams or FaceTime or something and see if we can talk about the automobile industry. There's some interesting things going on over the last week or two in that, particularly around the charging network and kind of the state of the state and you know, trying to hit these 2030 goals of, I mean, think about it. We're not too far away from 2022 at this point. And by 2022, that's 8 years to meet the 2030 goal of, you know, of having a majority of EVs on the roads, which will never happen. Because I hate to say it, but unless all the cars that are sold today fall apart, you're not going to get a majority of EVs on the road till probably 2065, 2070, and even then, I think that's a strong possibility that it ain't going to happen. But we will talk about that with Professor Sean, because he's the automotive expert and the automotive manufacturing expert as well. And if I want to, every time we do one on automotives, I want to talk to him and ask him if his statement is still going to hold true of, I will probably never own an EV. So, probably the big thing going on in September that's a kickoff in the technology world is Apple is supposed to have a series of events starting this month. I'm not sure, based on all the analyst reports I've read, everybody's certain that this month it's going to happen. We're going to get something from Apple. They were anticipating things before school started, before colleges went back to campus. I think part of what's setting that back is just the whole technology chip shortages. One analyst who's very, very well respected and in the know says Apple is okay on chip products through early 2022. It's going to be tough if they release new products to get any significant amount out. But, you know, Apple, Tim Cook, part of the reason he's the CEO of Apple is he is probably the greatest logistics expert in the world at this point. And, you know, understands that if I need to get product to sell, that means I got to order ahead or reserve that time, you know. The other thing all the analysts are saying is that expect all technology prices to go up. Anything that has a computer chip in it, whether it's a cell phone, a tablet, a computer, your car, it's all going to be hit by inflation just because of the shortage. And if you drive by, if you're on I-71 heading towards Louisville from Cincinnati, and you go past the Kentucky Speedway in Sparta, Kentucky, the parking lots there are filled with brand new Ford pickup trucks from the Ford plant on the northeast side of Louisville, and the reason they're sitting there is they do not have chips to operate those trucks to be able to sell them and meet the EPA guidelines. So, I mean, that, you know, you always look for proof when stuff like this has been announced, you know, because sometimes we get inflation just because somebody decided they would mark, you know, hey, somebody said there was inflation in the market so we can, you know, increase the price for our products. And in this case, they're not being able to sell products, and they're having to pay inventory tax on it. So even if they had the chips and they were sitting on trucks, they don't want to pay inventory tax on a product that isn't moving. So just expect that as we move into the Christmas season. Also, there's expect that everything will go up, because right now the port of Los Angeles, or the ports of Los Angeles and Long Beach, there's two separate ports, which is a major shipping, well, the major shipping ports for the U.S. to get imports from Asia, China, Japan, Taiwan, everywhere. They went from being, I think Fort Bloomberg Supply Lines newsletter said they went from being 2 days ago, went from being 14 days and 60 cargo container ships at sea waiting to get to the ports to over 21, and that it's going to get worse as we head into the holiday season, and you know, and that's everything. Those are all the products that, you know, millions of products and clothes and toys and everything is sitting out at sea right now, and they cannot get it in fast enough. Partly because of COVID on both the dock workers and crew, but also because of COVID on the ships. It's just a huge backlog. And, you know, a lot of that backlog was, they were within like 3 or 4 days back in June, but thanks to the Delta, that now this is what's being reported. Not, I don't know that this is totally true. A lot of it could also be the fact that people just aren't showing up for work.
It was my understanding that modern ports are mostly automated operations now.
Bringing the ship in is automated. The moving of all the cargo containers and sorting them and customs inspections and all of that is still largely manpower.
We should spend a couple $1 trillion on an infrastructure bill that would maybe do something about that.
Yeah, you know, we thought about that. But then we thought about, you know, rural broadband, which is being addressed by Starlink and AT&T already. We're going to give them money more money than we're going to spend on infrastructure. Since we're going down this segue, let's talk about the Brent Spence Bridge.
Okay, let's.
You know, the bridge was made by John A. Roebling, who also built the Brooklyn Bridge. It was actually the prototype of the Brooklyn Bridge. It's a double-decker bridge with southbound traffic on the upper deck and northbound traffic on the lower deck. And it is considered a historical monument, so it cannot be destroyed. But as, you know, when it was built, it was actually only two lanes in each direction. And then it had medians and it had areas to pull off and everything else. Well, as we, you know, progressed through the 20th century, all of that became four lanes in both directions on a bridge never designed for four lanes in both directions. And so by the end of the 80s, it was considered one of the 10 most dangerous bridges in the United States for car accidents, because if your car broke down, there was no place to pull off. There's no shoulder on the road. There's no place. And so we actually had thousands of people, and to this day have had thousands of people a year who are killed on that bridge because, you know, traffic, we live around it, so we know it, but the bridge actually, as you're going southbound, goes up a hill. And as you crest that hill is when you enter the bridge. Well, people would break down in one of the lanes and semis and stuff, because it's a major thoroughfare to get either, because right there is where I-75 and I-71 in the United States are a single highway. And semis would come up over there and they can't see and they're trying to gain speed, and then there's a broken down car in the lane and there's nowhere to go, and they just crush the cars, and they've killed people who were trying to change their tires. They've you know, the if you're broken down, this is what both the state of Ohio and state of Kentucky have told people, which is, do not get out of your car. Keep your seatbelt on. And wait. you know, and get it, you know, and before cell phones, it was much harder to do because you had no way to contact somebody to say, hey, I'm broken down on the bridge. But even to this day, we have hundreds of people killed on that bridge every year. And we've been promised federal money. The bridge is actually the responsibility of the state of Kentucky. You're talking about a state that has 2 to 3 million people, total population, most of which live in Louisville. And they just don't have
they don't have the political clout to pull that
they
off.
They don't have, not only do they have the political clout, they don't have the economic capability to build another bridge. They would have to stop every other public works project.
Which is why Kentucky has been essentially extorting Ohio.
Correct.
For years. But the thing about that bridge is it doesn't just benefit Kentucky and Ohio.
No, it's the whole corridor from Michigan all the way to Florida.
Some like, I read this somewhere, so don't hold me to the number, but it's significant. Some like 40% of all U.S. commerce goes across that bridge.
In one way or another.
And Congress can't get this figured out.
Yeah. Well,
They'll figure it out when it falls into the river.
Yeah.
But not before then.
Well, and, you know, the other dumb thing about the Brent Spence Bridge has been, so earlier this year, it was shut down for 6 weeks because we had a major accident with a tanker truck.
Yeah.
That had a spill on the bridge over the Ohio River.
Yes.
And so you were forced to drive around 275, which I don't see a problem with, except anybody wanting to deliver to downtown Cincinnati now have to go all the way around and then come back south to get there. But also, they've been painting it, which I understand the idea of painting it because it's a steel bridge. If you don't keep it painted, it won't keep the corrosion off of it, which will make the steel weak, which then could cause it to fall in the river.
But it's already functionally obsolete.
Correct. So not only that, we've actually had a whole bunch of accidents now because they have to shut down two lanes in each direction coming to the bridge. And again, now we're narrowing, we're going from four lanes of highway on both sides of it down to two, and it's just ridiculous how it's set up. It's just,
in the construction plan is to continue to operate that bridge while building the new one.
Mm-hmm.
They better get on it. We're about to spend $4 trillion on infrastructure in this country, and I guarantee you this bridge gets passed over again.
Actually, it's not even in the bill as one of the things to replace. Although it was brought up, both Rand Paul and Mitch McConnell.
There are no earmarks in either of the infrastructure bills currently. It's going to be up to how much does Kentucky get allocated, and does Kentucky want to replace that bridge once the time comes? I don't think they'll get enough, and I don't think it's going to happen.
I don't think it's going to happen either. Well, Kentucky could also alleviate a lot of problems with that bridge, right, particularly during construction, if they would only enforce. So Cincinnati, like many big cities, has a beltway, except Cincinnati's beltway crosses the Ohio River and goes all the way around northern Kentucky. And the Cincinnati Northern Kentucky Airport sits on the Kentucky side of the river off that beltway. Where there are not, on both east and west side, where it covers the, it goes over the river, there are bridges that are not functionally obsolete and four lanes of highway. And the idea of that, those beltways, is that traffic that is going past Cincinnati should be directed on the beltway and not over through downtown Cincinnati and over the bridge, unless you were delivering something to the inside of Cincinnati, which is going to be a fair amount of traffic.
Or inside the beltway.
Or inside the beltway.
Yeah.
But you could probably alleviate a lot, 50% of that traffic if both Ohio and Kentucky would actually enforce at the way stations that those trucks take the beltway around. But they won't. They don't enforce it
half the time.
Because they're not
half
open.
The time they're not open.
That's right.
Was the point I was just going to make. So yes.
Sorry, we're hitting a pet peeve of mine.
Oh no! But this has been my job for the last 3 months, is talking about how horrible this bill is and how it's not going to do what you think it's going to.
Well, and you know, let's take this back to what I was talking about inflation before on goods. Anytime that a major piece of infrastructure like this. So the problem is, it's probably more than 40% of all the goods and services in the United States travel on I-75, because it's like anything going east-west is I-70. I-75 and I-70 cross just north of Dayton, Ohio.
In Vandalia.
In
that
Vandalia.
Is correct.
And so a lot of people who are shipping ship up I-75 and across that bridge over I-70 all the way out to Colorado and beyond.
Correct.
And so I would estimate 40% being low. And
I
if they
say, the number I remember hearing was 60, but I think that's I think that sounds extraordinarily high when you're considering that this is the country's commerce. So I've been kind of dummying it down, but if I
would think it's probably 60% because of the connection with I-70. That takes you both east and west, because I-70 takes you to the east coast, I-70 takes you to the west coast, and it hits a lot of major towns and or in cities and shipping routes. So goods coming in and goods going out and being distributed go all the way along I-75 and I-70 across the United States. And then if you start taking 71 and 675 into the account, which also all are connected, you know, that's a huge amount of traffic. Any delays along there increases the shipping cost, which then adds to inflation. So,
to me, and then we can hop off this if you want.
The rant.
It took us 20 years and at least three presidential administrations to spend $2 trillion in Afghanistan. We're going to spend twice that in one bill.
Yeah. And that doesn't include all the infrastructure money that was allocated to the states because of COVID. You know, we got double hit here in the United, or here in Ohio, because we also got the gas tax increase. Okay, we're off that. Let's go back to technology. So, like I was saying before, supposedly Apple is going to have several events over the next couple of months. As we get more details, we'll talk about them. But we do believe that the iPhone event will be Monday, the 23rd of October. Now, that's if Apple doesn't, because this accidentally got leaked via Twitter by an Apple marketing executive. If they don't change the date just to be contrary, which Apple has been known to do. But they released an image of an iPhone, and you know, Apple does things subtly.
Will they push it up or back?
They might push it up.
That makes more sense.
There's supposed to be an event. They're saying that there's going to be at least a monthly event, if not two events in September and an October event. Now, last year, Apple had, in November, had a big event. I remember, because I was actually driving back from Huntsville, Alabama. And so I listened to the event on my phone in the car driving back. but that's when they released their M1 Apple sock. Max. And so there's at least three events. There might be more than that, because Apple's got a lot of stuff that they're probably going to update before the Christmas holiday season. And so you have your iPhone, the next iPhone. You have the next Mac event when they're supposed to release new MacBook Pros in a, both a 14th and a 16-inch variety with a supposed updated Apple chip in it, Apple system on a chip. There's rumors that they're going to update a couple other of their Mac products, so that might be a separate event. It might be the same event. You also have a few events. There's also talk of the low-end iPad getting updated, the AirPod third generation getting updated. So now some of that will be combined with other events, like, you know, the iPhone, iPad, AirPod might all be one event, but they have other products they're trying to update as well. The HomePod Mini might get an update. So I would expect, because one of the things, you know, Apple's always been good at marketing. One of the things they like to do is they like to do an event or event a month, or they'll do one event in the beginning of a month and one event in the end of the month, so that they can get their products out there. They also like to do an event, and that day or the next day, start pre-orders on that product so that they can ship them in 2 weeks. So hopefully we're going to hear a lot of new and fun and interesting stuff from them. There's also talk of some new products that they might be adding. So also, because they can't not copy Apple, Microsoft did a tweet and they're saying Windows 11 might drop on October 20th. And what they did is kind of the same thing. They show a picture of a Windows 11 desktop, and the date and time on it also show the date of October 10th, 2021, and a time. And you would actually have to, you'd have to specifically go in, since by default Windows 11 goes out and it checks the internet to check time and date. Microsoft is also talking about they're going to allow Windows 11 to be installed on older machines. They're kind of walking back their thing, but they will have to be manually updated. They won't get automatic updates like supported machines. But I don't know that people care, because automatic updates can be a pain in the ass.
As we have frequently talked about on this show.
Yes, yes. So, let's see what else is here. There's been more news. Intel's slowly getting their dedicated GPUs ramped up. But again, they're kind of being hindered by the chip shortage, which is making them want to build a... evidently, they're trying to get TSMC to build the cards and the chips for them. And TSMC is who Apple uses. And so Apple has a huge priority. Plus, almost every other vendor uses TSMC to build their chips, too, because they have the most advanced product. That's Taiwan Semiconductor. Intel is talking about building their own fab in the United States, or another fab in the United States. There's one fab in the world in the United States owned by IBM, but Intel wants their own. That'll be interesting, because fabs typically, they cost billions of dollars, not millions. They kind of have to be, they're iterative. So, you know, you build a fab, and you can build a chip at a certain, with a semiconductor of a certain size, and then you improve that process and you build smaller. And that's why TSMC has been around long enough that their iterations have gotten smaller and smaller and smaller. And, you know, it's not clear if Intel has the expertise to start as small as they're getting from TSMC today to then, you know, keep the iterations up going forward. And you have to ask yourself, if Intel owns it, are they going to be willing to build chips for other people? You know, other people's designs chips like Apple or...
Well, that'll come down to, as it always is it more profitable to maintain exclusivity of that facility, or is it more productive to the bottom line to share it?
Well, you know, that's going to be a question. And, you know, if you're building another fab in the United States, so like IBM's fab built, they build chips for other people. Because, you know, IBM's chip technology is the power chip, which used to be the power PC that Apple and Motorola and IBM created together. With Apple's new stuff, you know, they've been, when I say Apple's new stuff, you know, Apple's been making chips since the iPod, dedicated processors. Systems on a chip, they have a long and profitable relationship with TSMC. You know, so I don't know, but you know, part of the reason Intel is going this direction too is that they feel threatened. One, they can't get the production space on other world chip makers, but they also feel threatened by the new wave of ARM chips coming down. And it's not just Apple. They're seriously afraid, probably more afraid of, they're afraid of probably on the left hand of Apple on the desktop and laptop side, and they're afraid of NVIDIA on the server side, you know, and the graphics chip side.
And they should be.
And they should be. But that's what builds competition. So, you know, the issue, I think, for both like Apple and NVIDIA to go to, because NVIDIA uses TSMC too, to go to like Intel, if Intel was offering, is that what potential IP could be taken, you know, what, because that would be certainly be a big temptation, you know. I would rather see a company like Micron Technology out of Texas build a fab that's funded by Apple and NVIDIA and Intel at the same time, but owned by a company who's known for making memory chips and doesn't really have a game. You know, they build SSDs and they build RAM. Micron does. You know, and it would be nice to see a third party, if they could do it, do the manufacture of processors. That's part of the reason TSMC is so sought after, is not only the fact that they're extremely good at getting that process down smaller and smaller and smaller, which it defeats Moore's law every time they do it, but then also because they don't design their own chips, so they don't have any skin in that part of the game, you know.
But does that mean they would have to import talent to succeed in that game?
Intel would.
Well, Intel's going to do that anyway.
Yeah.
But I'm saying this third-party company.
TSMC already has the talent. They created the talent themselves. But you like Micron? Yeah.
Micron's what I was talking about.
I think they might import some talent, but I think because of their... So, I mean, everybody knows...
Or develop the talent,
I mean, back in the day, Micron built clone PCs, but they also owned Micron Memory, same company. They got out of the PC business, and they stayed in the memory business. Well, they've been around a long time. And today we know them... Their retail arm is Crucial, and if you look at all the new Crucial stuff, it says Crucial made by Micron. I think they have talent to do it, because the process of making a flash memory chip and making a CPU is not totally different, and the processes for breaking that down, you know, to make them smaller and more dense, which makes them more energy efficient and everything, and faster, is the same whether it is a CPU or it's memory or an SSD.
I get you.
So, but I mean, we'll have to see. Intel, they're talking about it. They certainly have the money to do it. But, you know,
Intel definitely should do it because they're dying anyway.
Well, it's kind of funny. So, you take Apple, you take Qualcomm, you take Nvidia, you take AMD on the processor side, and they're all doing things that are great for competition and are also threatening Intel's stranglehold.
Yes.
Pat Gelsinger moving from Dell EMC as the new CEO of Intel he's a marketing guy, but he's what I call a destructive marketing guy. He will either call you out, make fun of you, but he doesn't really tout what's good about you. You know, Intel has some great technologies. Thunderbolt is a great one. You know, it's a direct external way of doing PCIe and doing PCIe chains, so you can string multiple PCIe devices to a processor. I don't think they exploit that enough. You know, Intel developed USB 3. They developed USB 3.2, you know, and the USB-C standard. Yes, it's ubiquitous, but at this point, or almost ubiquitous, but again, they don't tout that capability, and they intentionally block competitors like AMD from being able to get access to, like, Thunderbolt. You know, so I think they hurt themselves trying to help themselves a lot of times. I also think they've taken the eye off the ball, like I said before. Things like USB-C and Thunderbolt and USB 3.2 make sense because those protocols along with the physical hardware are something that has to be built into a chip. But they bought Qlogic. They've bought a lot of companies to try to dabble in different things that they probably shouldn't have and should divest themselves from now. Some of the things that they've bought, they don't even have a market for anymore because nobody uses that technology. You know, and by the time they got around to doing something with it, it was already dead. You know, so they spent millions, if not billions of dollars on things that are no longer relevant. That being said, you talk about supply chain shortages. So Intel released their Gen 11 processors. I needed one because it has a special instruction set that I need for a specific application. And I already had, when I had built a machine earlier this year, I had, was smart enough to buy a Gen 11 motherboard that also ran Gen 10 chips because I could get a low-end Gen 10 chip pretty cheap, you know, and it could do 90% of what I needed to do. Well, Last Man Standing Micro Center has somehow gotten Intel Core i9s and i7s in that are 11th gen, and they're running a deal, but you have to go physically to the store. They won't sell them to you online, and you get a $400 processor for like $280. You know, quad core, or not quad core, 8-core, octa-core. But I'll tell you, I mean, it's a great chip, but I benchmarked it against my Ryzen 7, which is 2 generations old. And on my benchmark, they're both octa-core chips. My Ryzen is 4x the performance of an 11th gen i7 octa-core chip. So Ryzen 7 correlates to Intel i7. you know, because there's a Ryzen 9 that would correlate to an R9. And looking at the benchmarks, so Alder Rocket Lake is the current 11th gen. Alder Lake is the 12th gen that should be released sometime in January. We're hoping. Probably won't see the market, really see the market until April or May. For PC builders. But the benchmarks between Rocket Lake and Alder Lake don't look good. Like, why would you bother to buy it? You know? And that's kind of Intel's roadmap. They're banking everything on what is it called? They call it their Zen 5 killer, which is the next iteration of AMD chips, because Zen is the AMD architecture. Oh, Royal Core. It's supposedly Royal Core is the successor to the Core I family today. So it's like the next gen but it's Alder Lake's successor is Raptor Lake, which is the Royal Core. And so their goal is to kill off that's going to be their Zen 5 AMD killer on the desktop. I don't think it's going to happen. I guess it's called Lunar Lake is what they're which doesn't even come out for 2 years, so it's a generation after the Alder Core or Alder Lake, because there's Alder Lake, Raptor Lake, Meteor Lake, Arrow Lake, and then Lunar Lake. So they have, in the next 2 years, they have four revisions coming out before they even get to their Zen 5 killer. Okay, so in 2 years, what is AMD going to do? I'm sure AMD's just going to go, look, it's fast enough. We're not going to do any R&D for 2 years and release new products. Because that never happens, you know. You don't need to release a new product every year. What's scary about Intel's roadmap and their plan is, so one of the things they're trying to do is they're trying to take something from, and this is what the Alder Lake is their, I think their first generation of doing this, is they're trying to copy ARM in the sense of you will have performance cores and you will have general cores. So the performance cores can handle all the threads that are super high performance, and then the general cores, which are more power efficient, can handle things that have less priority. Alder Lake is supposed to do that. So they're stealing an idea, which is called a big little concept from the ARM chips. But the benchmarks on chips that are, from a gigahertz standpoint, are higher than the current 11th gen Rocket Lakes, the benchmarks show that they're not getting great throughput. There would be almost no reason to upgrade, which was the problem that they've had with the 10th gen to 11th gen. So not only do you have the chip shortage from the 11th gen just because they can't get enough chips out, but unless there's something specific you need, like I needed the AVX 512 extension, which doesn't exist prior to 11th gen in the desktop chips, only in the Xeon chips for servers, there's almost no performance difference between the equivalent i7 10th gen versus the i7 11th gen. So they're trying to take out AMD. I think AMD is trying to become more like the ARM makers. You know.
Well, and why wouldn't they? Because that's where the action is.
Well, that's where the greatest improvements in both performance and power efficiency and everything else we're going to see.
Yes.
Is in that. And, you know, I hate to say it, but as much as I've enjoyed x86 architecture over the years, I've never been tied to it, you know, as the only architecture I'd be willing to look at. You know, it just, technologies age, and eventually they hit a dead end, and they either need to be, you know, Intel is trying to add some of the ARM capabilities, thinking it's going to work for them. But the reality of it is, you know, the ARM development went, you know, back when cell phones started to become prolific, ARM development took a step sideways, and they kind of, you know, their goal was to become super power efficient then, you know, because they were. ARM chips were more power efficient. But now that ARM has developed so much, and you know, companies like Apple have spent so much time designing their own chips so that not only can they do the low power stuff, but they can do the performance things that have gotten them on par with x86 and now exceeded x86 and x64, they're way ahead of the game, you know?
Well, and that's what's so bizarre about Intel's plan. I mean, they're trying to challenge AMD when that's not going to, they're not going to survive.
Correct.
Because they're focused on the wrong, well, the wrong
problem,
technology.
Well, the problem is, and I understand it, Intel is probably a million times bigger than the Titanic with 1/1,000th the rudder. And trying to get that ship turned with a rudder that small is almost impossible. And so, because think about how Intel does business. So, yeah, Intel sells chips retail. You buy them in little blue boxes, you know. But the majority of the business they do is bulk sales to PC makers. So you got Microsoft with their Surface products. You got Dell EMC. You got Lenovo. You got HP, or HP Inc., not HPE. Asus, you know, there's a few other makers out there. But there's the market for PCs is definitely a lot smaller, you know, as far as variety of manufacturers. And they sell probably the majority, I would say they probably sell 85% of their product worldwide that they produce to those folks. And but those folks can be much more nimble than Intel when they see the change coming. See, right now what's hampering HP and Dell and Lenovo and a lot of these PC makers from going the ARM route is that to a large degree, they think they need Microsoft. And until Microsoft, which it's going to happen, it's not a question of if, it's a question of when. When Microsoft, who already sells ARM-based Surface products, which are, you know, a premium Windows device, when they sell those, they decide that the Windows 11 and Windows 10 that's available for those devices on ARM can go to Dell and HP. And they're testing it right now. I mean, I think HP has a ARM-based Windows 10 device that's out there, and I think Dell might have one too. I haven't really looked at Dell, but I know I've seen the HP one. I think there's a Lenovo one too, you know. When they see that the people are willing to pick those devices up, there will be a wholesale shift to ARM. You know, and a lot of it is dependent on things like Qualcomm with their Snapdragon is now starting to develop their own ARM chips instead of using the ARM reference architectures to kind of build their chips so that they get specialized cores to do things. And but the current Snapdragon that's in the Surface Pro X is good enough, and I think that's the same Snapdragon that's being used in the Lenovo and HP versions. It's gonna happen, and it's gonna crush a good part of Intel's business. X86 chips aren't going away for a long while, don't get me wrong. But if there's a wholesale move on the hate calling it consumer because it's not really consumer. It's because it's consumer and business. But on the PC business, you know, laptops, desktops, to ARM, that's going to significantly hamper a lot of Intel's work. The other side of it, though, is the threat from NVIDIA. And Intel is fighting NVIDIA along with Google and a whole bunch of other companies who don't own, and Qualcomm, who don't own original ARM licenses like Apple does, because they bought a processor company back in the late 90s. They're fighting NVIDIA buying ARM Incorporated. Because if NVIDIA owns that technology, effectively NVIDIA becomes the new Intel. Not only for moving to ARM on the desktop side, the PC side, but moving to ARM on the server side, which, since Linux is the most prolific server operating system today, I mean, if it weren't, there wouldn't be Linux instances on AWS or Microsoft Azure or Linux versions of Microsoft SQL Server. Those are already optimized for ARM. Ubuntu, Debian, Red Hat, they all have optimized ARM versions, because HP has the Moonshot servers that they sell a ton of, which are, Moonshot is all ARM-based servers. Now, one of the things that you got to understand why the industry will move to ARM is, one, on the PC, laptop, desktop, tablet side of it, ARM chips are so much more power efficient that even using the same battery technology, you're getting twice the runtime out of the product at the same performance. And even if it isn't at the same performance, it's good enough performance for most people that it doesn't matter. Otherwise, Chromebooks wouldn't be so prolific.
Yes. Agreed.
And that's why Google doesn't want NVIDIA to have it, because then essentially NVIDIA would get to control Chrome OS and Chromebooks. On the server side, one of the easiest ways to make your data centers, you know, whether you're AWS or you're a private corporation or whatever, lower your costs, make you green, at least in the definition of what they call green, is if you can move to something that is more power efficient, doesn't require as much cooling, more heat tolerant, which is why the HP Moonshot servers have been very, very popular. Because just the economics of it, the power savings alone is compelling for large data centers to want to move to it.
That makes
and
perfect
then,
sense.
And then the fact that, you know, you can then do things like, you know, even on from Google, like, you know, using their AI cards and things to, and AI chips, which are all ARM-based, to do specific analysis of data and things, they're getting more capability by moving to a more power-efficient technology. I mean, it's kind of the same argument that you have with I do caveat this, it's kind of the same argument, except you probably really will see an economic impact as a corporation from this, which I'm not sure you're going to see an economic impact by moving to electrical vehicles or EVs. But it's kind of the same thing. You know, the idea is that the new electric vehicles are so much more efficient than gas vehicles, and particularly as we go along, that you know, the savings alone and just in your pocket should be the same, or it should be great. But that's my rant on technology right now. So let me see what else we have to talk about. Matt's eyes are starting to glaze over. So let's go to the few entertainment things. Oh, one other thing. So we talked about the infrastructure bill, and you know, companies like Starlink and Verizon are already with the Verizon Get 5G program, where you can get unlimited internet at 300 megabits down, and I forget what it was up, but it's significant, for $80 a month, and it's wireless. But Starlink alone, and they're still in the beta phase, where you're having to shuck out $500 of your own money to buy the equipment, has sold 100,000 terminals. That's significant.
But while we're on the Starlink thing, I heard something the other day that I wanted to ask you about. They're talking about in the next generation of those satellites, they were going to put in some sort of laser communication system that would network the satellites with each other.
So it's my understanding that today those satellites are networked with each other. The idea with the laser communication, because so the problem with Starlink today, and it's not really a problem, it's just it can be an annoyance for a small subset, probably of Starlink subscribers, which is the way those microsats work, they sit in a much lower orbit so that the communication signals between the ground stations and the satellites are faster because radio waves can only travel so fast.
Right.
So the way it kind of works today, the satellites do talk to each other, but the basically when you connect from ground, you talk to a satellite and you're only connected to that satellite for like 10 minutes because it's built like a moving cell network.
Right.
Where you're stationary, but the network moves. And so what happens to happen is there has to be a handoff from one satellite to the other, and they're communicating with each other. And then the satellites, it's handing off two connections. It's handing off the connection to your dish at your property, and it's handing off the connection to the ground station that's connected to a internet trunk where you get connection to the internet. So there's latency, not only from the radio waves and interference, which causes retries. So it makes the latency higher. And so gamers who want as close to zero latency as possible, sometimes your latency can go outside what would be acceptable for them. If you're checking email, surfing the web, watching streaming video, it's 100 megabits down typically and about 20 megabits up throughput, but the latency falls in this kind of middle, what I call a middle latency range, because you can see that same range on cable internet depending on how busy or how many high-speed customers are in your area and on your network. Like COVID, where I live out in the rural area, when everybody was at home and everybody was streaming, we would see the latency go up sometimes because, and if you go to my mom's neighborhood, even today, she's on the end of a link. And so with everybody's cell phones on the network and we try to watch something on streaming TV, the latency goes up high, so it causes buffering on whatever you're streaming. But it only happens when people get home from work and they start watching TV after dinner, you know. So that's the downside of Starlink, is that right now it's typically 100 meg, which, you know, you, Spectrum, they're low. Well, Spectrum's kind of medium $80 a month plan is 200 meg down and like 25 meg up. The AT&T Get 5G plan, which I'd be interested, or not AT&T, it's Verizon, which I'd be interested in, is it's actually $50 a month for the equipment and a $30 unlimited internet plan. It's 300 down and I think it's about 30 meg up. But it's different because I imagine it's kind of your mileage will vary on it, because it'll be how close are you to a 5G tower and how many 5G customers are there at any given time.
The question that I had for you was, there was some competitor who was trying to stop Starlink from equipping these satellites with this laser communication system for some reason I cannot fathom.
I cannot remember what it was. Well, part of it is so that the laser system is one is to improve the communications between, because what they're hoping is that eventually they want to get to the point where they talk to you via laser, which is much faster, speed of light.
Right.
And then they can, it's like a mesh network that they can transfer you all around, and so they don't have to have as many ground stations.
So my question is, the only thing that makes sense of why a competitor would want to prevent that is if that system then interferes with whatever it is they're trying to do as a competitor.
I don't know how that works. I remember vaguely reading a couple months ago about that, because also, you know, as Starlink's trying to also do the mobile internet, so that, you know, you put a Starlink terminal on a ship, or you put a Starlink terminal on, eventually they're thinking that you get like micro Starlink terminals and people can have them in their RVs and their cars, and, you know, semis can have them. And laser communication is right now is how they're talking about, like, if we move people to Mars, how do we connect them to the internet and communicate? Well, right. Laser communication is the way. We've been doing it since the 60s, we've been doing laser communication with the moon. The most basic thing we've done is they set up a mirror on the moon, and NASA was shooting lasers at it to
bounce back
and figure out, you know, some scientific information. And so, you know, that's kind of where they're at with it. I think the satellites that have gone up have the capability to do it. It's just they're not doing it because the terminals at both the ground stations and at individual people's terminals are not there yet. Because the one thing I do know is that, and that's why I find it amazing that it's 100,000 and not 10,000. Because 10,000 terminals is a lot, but Starlink is, it's costing them over $1,000 to build a terminal. Because Dishy McDishface, what they name the terminal, is a very powerful computer in and of itself. And it actually, when you turn it on, you know, like today when you install DirecTV, somebody has to manually figure out where your satellite is and kind of tune your dish in, and you better hope to God that, you know, it's tightened down and it doesn't get hit by somebody on a lawnmower or a branch, and it moves it where it takes out your, yeah, and then you have to try to figure out your satellite program, you know, to get it hooked back up. It automatically tracks those satellites. It also heats itself to melt snow off the satellite, because snow will interfere with the communication. There's a guy on YouTube named Jeff Geerling. He does a lot of Raspberry Pi stuff. He's also a big Mac user, and he's also written a book on Ansible, which is fantastic if you're into data center automation. But he has been doing a long-term test of Starlink at his house, along with versus his Spectrum cable internet. And it's been interesting to watch those videos, and he does a good job graphing and charting everything, and he's using some open source tools to monitor both network connections, and you know, and he's also giving you the impression of what it feels like. You know, does it feel like, is it too slow or whatever? So you know, go check him out, Jeff Geerling, at YouTube, Geerling. He's out of St. Louis. Because he's articulate and has a lot to say, and I think it's compelling information if you're interested in Starlink.
Cool.
You know, the problem with Verizon's plan right now is it's really, I've signed up because it's actually $10 cheaper than and 100 megabits more. So when it comes to our area, I can get it, but right now, Ohio and 5G do not coexist. There might be some 5G in Columbus, but I bet that's about it.
I would question even that.
Well, I mean, if you get into 5G,
there might be pockets of it.
The problem with 5G versus 4G, and then the problem with 4G versus 3G, is wave propagation of radio waves. So every time we switch from 3G to 4G to 5G, we make a compromise. And the compromise is to get more bandwidth, we have to go to a higher frequency. So higher frequency means that the radio waves travel much shorter distances. And so the problem with Verizon and AT&T and now T-Mobile and Sprint's 5G rollout is dependent upon getting lots more cell towers or cell arrays to propagate 5G radio waves across the area. And so the problem is so with 5G, it is the increase in frequency to get the increase in bandwidth is so great that Verizon and them, even in the big cities where they have much greater control over putting a lot of new cell sites out, can't keep up getting enough cell sites out so that there's coverage. I mean, that's why I would tell you today, unless you live in New York or Washington, D.C., and even in those places, it's in pockets. I wouldn't tell you to go buy a 5G phone because you want 5G. And that's going to be the thing that right now is going to probably hamper the rollout of 5G internet service by Verizon. Now, the thing I love about Starlink and the fact that Verizon is doing this is it's truly bringing competition. So your local cable provider or AT&T, who doesn't even do DSL anymore, are going to have to be much more competitive in the market. And since, cable companies have become internet providers because there every year hundreds of thousands of people unsubscribe from cable TV and just get internet because the compelling things are on the streaming services, not on, I mean, and you talk about the big networks, ABC, NBC, CBS, and Fox, they're good shows, and the shows that people want to see are on the streaming service, not being broadcast. And part of that is because it's also a way to get around FCC censorship. You know, if you want a character to act like and speak like somebody in a drama like they really would, hence Paramount Plus and the fact that, and Star Trek, they cuss. But it does make, the suspension of disbelief, it increases that a lot because it makes it more real, and people aren't speaking the Queen's English in perfect diction. And so, well, I think we've kind of beat all of that to death, particularly the Brent Spence Bridge part, but I did enjoy covering it because now I feel better.
Me too.
So thank you for listening to us. We want to hear your feedback, so please send us some feedback to gizmosapiens@gmail.com. Please reference the episode number. This one's episode 182. Or visit our website at www.gizmosapiens.com, and we'll see you on the digital flip side.
You've been listening to Gizmo Sapiens, a technology and entertainment podcast. You can reach us at our email address at gizmosapiens@gmail.com. That's gizmosapiens@gmail.com. We'd really love to hear from you, and we'll see you next week from the digital flip side.